This message comes from NPR sponsor, the Capital One Venture Card. Earn unlimited 2x miles on every purchase. Plus, earn unlimited 5x miles on hotels and rental cars booked through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Welcome to World Cafe. Hey, I'm Kaleo. Charlie Crockett doesn't do things halfway. Ever. The story has often been told. He started out busking in cities like New Orleans and New York City, ended up on the wrong side of a busted record label contract, self-funded his own independent releases, and made a name for himself with his relentless work ethic, putting out over a dozen albums in less than a decade. His latest, $10 Cowboy, is a record, unsurprisingly, written from the road, sketching out characters, fictional and otherwise, talking about life in a country he's traveled across countless times. Today's conversation offers a glimpse into what someone goes through on their path to being a successful touring artist. He's not afraid to reflect on the industry he's had to navigate, often through his own devices. He also looks back on the inspirations of his, like Aretha Franklin and Willie Nelson. We'll get into it with Charlie Crockett in just a moment, after the title track from his new album. Here's $10 Cowboy on World Cafe.
I'm a $10 cowboy. Maybe that's a fact. I got some inhibitions that might be holding me back. And I've been seeing this portrait attached to a small fee. Oh, a $10 cowboy who looks a lot like me.
It's Charlie Crockett with the title track to his new album, $10 Cowboy. And it follows his 2022 release, The Man from Waco. Charlie is my guest today on World Cafe. I am Kaleo. It is so nice to meet. Welcome back to the cafe.
Well, thanks for having me.
The album is $10 Cowboy. And I was reading the phrase came from an experience that you had in South Padre Island. Someone called you that? What happened?
Yeah. Well, when you adorn yourself with a cowboy hat and get decked out like I do, a lot of ordinary people are quick to make fun of you, you know, because, you know, these days everybody dresses the same. People say that what you wear doesn't have anything to do with the content of your character, but I'm not sure that's true. If your clothes are made in Vietnam or Cambodia, that might say something about you, especially if you don't even realize it. Right. And I'm dapped out in dead man's clothing, so I'm sure it says something about me, too. I bought this jacket in L.A. when I was there. I just made a record last week, a whole other record. And God dang, you know, the thing is I make records pretty fast and the business moves awful slow. And so it's really hard to sit around and wait for the industry to catch up in the album release cycle. I can tell you it gets to wear on you. But Taylor Grace got me this jacket from this vintage dealer, and it had the guy's name, you know, in the jacket there. And we were sitting there in Hollywood on Sunset. I was making a record with Shooter Jennings, and the guy that was filming the whole thing, a guy named Jared Christopher from Fort Worth, he Googled the guy's name and they found his obituary. And I had never done something like that before. So immediately, and the guy's reading his obituary out loud to me, and I said, holy moly, this guy died a year ago. You know, and here I am wearing his damn jacket. I think $10 Cowboy, that when this person said it to me, I think it was kind of the equivalent of calling me a dime store cowboy or drugstore cowboy. And I guess I've sort of made a career out of taking those, taking slights and publishing them.
Turning them into songs. Yeah, I love that you made it the album title, like a different kind of calling card.
Yeah, well, I like the way it sounded. Personally, I like the way it sounded, you know, and I really remember a time, as many years have gone by, it really just feels like only yesterday, that a $10 bill in my guitar case felt like a whole lot of money, man. I've never forgotten that, you know? I mean, I spend money like it's going out of style, but I think, you know, mostly that's because, I mean, I play for the dollar bill, but it don't own me, you know, and I don't ever want it to. But I'm good at that. I'm good at coming up with songs, and if you give me an unrealistic deadline and put me in a room, or I put myself in a room with great players who know me, I can finish songs pretty damn quick.
Yeah.
You know?
No joke, with over a dozen records in the last decade, you do have a knack for it.
This one here is $10, my 14th, and I actually, and then I've got number 15 is, I just finished it, you know.
And here we are talking about a record that you probably finished over a year ago, but
yeah, man.
They got to keep the labels having a hard time keeping up with you. So what would you say the premise of $10 Cowboy was?
Well, you know, you said labels are having a hard time keeping up with me. Those labels need to get with it because I'm not the only one. I'm serious, man. There's two ways that this game is played. You know, there's the labels game. And then there's, for lack of a better word, the Willie Nelson model. And that one's rare. And the reason that it's rare is because, you know, and I'm not blaming them, but it's like, you know, the label wants to control all variables they can. And so they're always looking to sign somebody, possibly young, blow them up real quick. And if it works out that it blows up, they throw gasoline on it. I don't blame them for that. I understand why they do it that way. You know, it's not just the music business that's, you know, trying to buy it cheap and sell it deep real quick and then pass the buck on down the line and all the problems, you know, that might come with that way of doing business. As long as somebody else is left holding the bag, they don't mind. They're signing young people up to 4-record deals and moving in these 2-year album cycles, and they're not really even spending a lot of money on them, you know? So it can feel a bit like being handcuffed when the labels are sitting there running these 2-year record cycles, you know, down in the so-called Americana scene, behaving like majors, but not even spending the money. You know, that's a frustrating thing because I remember a woman said it in an interview about Jimi Hendrix after he had passed. It's really great documentary about him, maybe you've seen it, and she was talking about how an artist isn't the same person 6 months from now. And you know, the beauty of that model in the 60s and 70s, as difficult as it was, and I'm not saying it was easy, you know, I'm not, you know, Waylon Jennings would tell you that it was no cakewalk, but the thing is, they got to put out records pretty dang quick. I'd like to think that I've had just a little bit of something to do with the Nashville system, at least realizing that slow game, you know, it's no fun. You know, it doesn't work, you know. It doesn't work for artists. It works for management companies. It works for labels. It doesn't work for artists. You know, and people could, you know, love me or hate me, you know, I am an artist, you know, and so that's what I've been trying to do is, you know, I just like putting out records faster, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I think they're the ones that need to change their tune.
How do you navigate this, I mean, in some ways a very antiquated system?
Look, man, when they signed me, and David Macias be the first person to tell you this. You know, the reason I love that man is there's an element of him that reminds me of the guys that used to run Columbia Records out of like New York in the 60s. You know, they were basically gangsters and they didn't know what was going to sell. But the cool thing about those old timers was, is they took chances and they knew they didn't know. See what I'm saying? Whereas now I'm just saying they've got it so parted out. They've got it so tightly controlled. It's so set up to win and never lose in the management, agent, label system that, you know, it's kind of like trying to juice a rock or something, you know. But when Macias signed me, you know, he didn't understand what I was doing. There's kind of this belief that, you know, the model is one artist blows up and pays for 20 failures.
Yeah.
You know, that's how they look at it in the big machine. And then even I found that even the small machine, the tiny Nashville machine, was just a, you know, it was just like a little baby version of that, you know, where instead of advancing you 750 grand that like they might do in New York or LA, they would maybe, you know, advance you 75 G's on your record, right? And let me tell you how that went on the first one. 40 of it went to the damn producer in the studio. 30 of it went to the damn publicist and nothing happened. And I think the other $5,000 I spent on whiskey, you know, because I was playing 7 days a week. The long point I'm getting around to here is this, is that that record, the money was gone. And so after that first record didn't do anything, all that money being spent, man, I thought $75,000 was just, you know, an insurmountable, you know, sum at the time. But the very next record that I put out after that, and, you know, it's called The Valley. And I made that record for like $6,000, you know, and I turned it into Macias, and Macias goes, this is not a commercial album. We're not going to take it to radio. We're not even going to market it, but we will put it out. You know what I mean? And that's the thing I'm saying is the graciousness of David Macias was that he would say, I don't think this is going to sell, but I'll distribute it. And that's where our relationship started to blossom, you know, was from, you know, a record that I guess was a commercial failure to, you know, here we are putting out number 14 on the scenic route. <You know?
laughs> Yeah. We're talking with Charlie Crockett here on World Cafe. The latest album is called $10 Cowboy. Up next, we're going to listen to America. This song sounds so good. Like, so good, especially on the heels of the title track, which opens the record. What should people know about it before we get into it, we listen to it?
I wrote that song in the parking lot of the Kansas City Star Casino. In the middle of the night, parked way at the back of the lot there, in the back of my tin can bus. I've written a lot of songs, in the parking lots of casinos, or hell, sitting at slot machines.
Fertile ground for creativity.
I think so. Every once in a while, because I spend so much of my life playing the hurry up and wait game, those songs will just kind of come to me, you know, and that's a good example of one that kind of came to me all at once.
It's Charlie Crockett from his new album, $10 Cowboy. This is America.
America, how are you? I hope you're doing fine. America, I love you. And I feel you sometime. America, you know why? Hard to understand. America, please forgive me. I'm only a man.
The song is America. It's from Charlie Crockett. America. It's on his new album, $10 Cowboy. Charlie's my guest today. I am Kaleo. It's World Cafe. So you recorded at Arlen Studios in Austin, Texas, and I saw that you were like hesitant for a moment to go into a big studio to record. Is that a new thing? What was sort of your aversion to like hitting up like a, you know, a major studio?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think I had no business being in those places.
Oh, come on.
No, really? I'm serious. I mean, have you listened to my records? You should go back to my earlier records. I mean, they're recorded in barns and farmhouses and shotgun houses and the Treme. I just didn't. I was intimidated by the big studios. Honestly, I was avoiding them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that if I would have gone into Arlen even 1 year prior, it would have been, I would have been a wasted effort, just because, you know, I never, you know, people always talk about this imposter syndrome and all this kind of stuff. I never had anything like that, you know. I didn't get started, and I backed into this profession through kind of it's a career of last resort. I'm serious, you know. I really did learn how to play music in public in front of people, you know. No one can take that away from me. That's my life. That's my truth. That's my reality. So I was never anybody who was some kind of, you know, child prodigy or come from money or any of this kind of stuff where you're like, I'm going to be a star or a pro athlete or any of this kind of stuff. You know, I just was playing in public so I could get away with it. Because it is, and for the most part, what I found growing up, my mama was working a couple of jobs minimum forever, never got home till 9 o'clock at night. You know, in that kind of environment, it's, you know, we lived in a really small place. You know, she's the one that got me the guitar in the first place, but I was afraid to play it in front of her. And we lived in such a tiny damn, you know, spot that, you know, I didn't feel like I could even play in there, you know? And so I was, you know, playing outside to, you know, to get away with it and not to be heard by anybody or whatever. And it kind of evolved into this, man, because once I found out that I could exchange those songs I was writing on the guitar for a meal, that's the closest thing to being free that I've ever encountered. And I just never could let it go. But I'm saying, you know, I didn't think that I had any business in those fancy studios.
It doesn't sound like that's the natural environment of you, the artist.
Yeah, I just didn't. I was intimidated by it, scared of it, in my head about it, you know? And like I'm saying, you know, the first time anybody ever gave me an advance on a record, you know, all of it got spent right up front because it was a big fancy studio. I liked the place, but man, you just end up, you know, they just end up, and they don't even mean to, but they just take your lunch, man.
Oh,
you know,
man.
And you know, and I just didn't have time for that. So the Arlen thing was different because the reason that we went in there, this is the whole of it, is that I've been recording on tape pretty much the whole time. And I've always found that the more live the recording, the more people that are maybe drawn to what I do can connect with me or believe me. It's not really about the tape. 2-inch tape sounds really good. It really does. Smells real good when they're running it in the room too. It really does. You know, you get used to it. It's like growing up smelling diesel fuel, you know, you just like it. But, you know, so, but it's not about the tape itself. It's that back in the day, because of, you know, technological and time constraints, money constraints, what you hear on a tape machine from, say, you know, Aretha Franklin down in Muscle Shoals, you know, when she was breaking through on her ninth and 10th record. What you're hearing is the magic of the performance being captured by people who did it live in the room.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. That's missing these days, and not entirely, but there's a large segment of the business that there's not even an opportunity to capture that magic because it's totally parted out from the beginning. So I've been doing live and getting bigger and bigger bands, more and more people playing together live. So the reason that me and Billy Horton ended up going to Arlen through process of elimination, it was the biggest room in Austin that we could find, that we could run a tape machine and I could have 10, 11, 12 people tracking all at once.
Yeah.
See what I mean? So like, you know, I finally went to a big studio, paid for it myself, purely out of, you know, a physical necessity for the, you know, that being the one room in that town that could accommodate us.
When I listened to the album, it was instantaneous to me that I knew this was a band playing live to tape, which is a magic that, you know, you don't get sometimes. And especially, I think it affects the performance of the artist. Because if you're in a room tracking vocals and you're listening to some band playing, you're going to give a different performance than if you're in the room and there's a trust that comes with all of the other players who you're looking eye to eye with. Did it feel good? Did it feel good in the moment when you were tracking it?
Yeah. I knew that I was getting through the door to another room, you know, to another place. You know, I really did. I'm real proud. I'm really, really proud of it. That, you know, $10, I really am. As I've gotten older, I've been finding each morning I wake up that I'm better at saying what I want to say. How I want to say it, you know, I can play what I hear in my head better than I could last year. You know, I feel like each year I see more clearly, you know, really, which is maybe the most, you know, beautiful thing about getting older, as much as I'm afraid of it. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know, it's like, sounds ridiculous, but it's like movies that I didn't understand when I was a kid make so much better sense to me now. You know, I appreciate the seasons so much more, you know, than I did when I was younger. You know, it's like when I was in LA making this last record just a couple weeks ago, and the jasmine was in bloom throughout West LA, and then it was the heaviest fragrance of flowers in bloom I had ever, you know, encountered. And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, is it truly the strongest blooming spring in the history of the world, or am I just noticing? I think I'm just noticing.
I love that. We're talking with Charlie Crockett here on World Cafe. The new album is called $10 Cowboy. One more song to get to. Everyone take a listen to this from $10 Cowboy. It's Solitary Road.
I'd be glad to tell you the story about a solitary road. You can't take nobody with you, and you ain't coming back if you go. It's a highway teeming with blackjack. On every corner, young Jezebel. Well, they say it can lead to salvation, but you won't be able to tell, 'cause it's a solitary road.
From the new album, $10 Cowboy, it's Charlie Crockett. That is Solitary Road. Charlie, always a pleasure. You always have a home here at World Cafe. Anytime you want to come back and see us, okay?
Y'all are really too kind. I appreciate the opportunity. I recognize it's one. Thank you.
You got it. Charlie Crockett, we're back in a minute with more World Cafe.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.